This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There were two big deals that made the headlines today. Mortgages was one, Greece was the other. Both had been rumored for months. But hey, what's a deadline for, if not to be broken? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 9th of February. State attorneys general and federal regulators, along with the five biggest mortgage servicers, that'd be Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase, to name just two, have come to a long-awaited $25 billion agreement. The banks, among other things, will be punished for wrongly foreclosing. Borrowers who owe more than their homes are worth will be helped. And maybe, just maybe, somewhere in the process there, the housing market itself will get a little something out of it, too. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us going today.
Under the settlement, the five banks will pay up to $2,000 to people who lost their homes to foreclosure. For some homeowners who owe more than their houses are now worth, banks will have to cut the size of their loans.
That's a drop in the bucket compared to the scope of the problem.
Georgetown law professor Adam Levitin says U.S. homeowners owe a collective $700 billion more than their houses are worth, and the settlement would only cut that by about $20 billion. Also, the settlement will only help about one out of every 10 underwater homeowners.
So you're going to have a handful of homeowners who basically win the lottery here, and many others who are going to find out there's nothing for them.
Phil Burgum is hoping to win the lottery. For the past 2 years, he's lived 200 miles away from his wife. That's because he found a job but can't sell his house in Andover, Minnesota. That's because his mortgage with Chase is $50,000 more than his home is worth. He says cutting his loan down to size would solve a big problem.
It would raise the possibility of being able to sell the house. I could actually, live with my wife again for a while.
Harvard housing economist Nicholas Ritsinas says this settlement isn't the ultimate solution to the housing problem, but it's a significant step. That's because the banks will have to cut the principal amount of the loan, not just the interest rate.
There have been some efforts in the past to introduce this concept of principal reduction, but they've been pretty much catch-as-catch-can. This would be the first significant effort to do so.
Government officials say they hope 9 additional banks will sign on to the settlement. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
News, of course, is nothing without context, especially a $25 billion or more financial settlement that took more than a year to negotiate. So we've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore with us live to contextualize. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So Stacey was talking about the consumers and the borrowers. Talk to me about the banks for a second. What does this deal mean?
Sure. Well, financially, it means really little to them. The banks only have to cough up about $5 billion at first, which for them is tiny. They get through that by lunchtime. And basically, the big benefit is that now they have one less thing to worry about when they're cleaning up the mortgage mess.
Well, talk to me about that for a second. Where are we in the cleanup of the mortgage mess?
Sure. Well, basically, the banks have so much stuff to clean up that it's almost like that show Hoarders. Have you ever seen that?
Right? Where people... it's actually quite scary, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. Where people accumulate junk for years and years.
Yeah.
Well, it's maybe not as scary as banking, but they're very much, banks are like mortgage hoarders. They get sentimental about money. So they've been hanging on to billions in these mortgage securities. And for the past few years, they've had to own and manage actual houses.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Michael Yoshikami how long all of this would take. He's an investor in Citigroup. And here's how he described how long it would take the banks to work through the backlog of mortgages and houses.
Hmm. Banks still have massive inventory of property. So banks really are going to have to work off this real estate excess probably for another 5 years.
Right. And the banks don't even want any more foreclosures. They don't want to manage the houses.
Right. That's a great point, that the banks are actually in the real estate business now, which is kind of crazy. All right. So this deal has been such a long time in coming. Are things going to change?
Well, one thing is going to change, which is the Department of Justice is looking at mortgages. Mm-hmm. So we know it's going to get bigger. But let's change the tenses. Things are changing, right? So there are benefits to people who aren't even in this deal. One of them is that the banks have to be more responsible about pursuing foreclosures. They have to do them one by one, not all in a giant group like they've been doing. And they actually have to communicate with anyone who's delinquent. And they have to modify those loans more quickly. And they have to make the whole process move more slowly. So that's progress for anybody facing foreclosure. And now we have it in writing.
Yeah, I hesitate to ask what's now on my mind, but I'm going to anyway, because it's kind of relevant. Have the banks learned their lesson? Will things actually change? I mean, you say they're changing, but come on.
Yeah, well, the banks have learned how to write a big check, but I feel like they already knew that.
One more thing I want to know before we go, actually, is what's the next step? There's talk now of a deal with nine more smaller banks that have another huge percentage of the housing market. We're not done with this thing yet.
No, not by a long shot. All the attorneys general can still pursue more action against all of the banks, and especially in the case of the most powerful one, the New York State Attorney General, he's going to do it.
Yeah. Also, just for trivia's sake, so this was a 49-state deal. Who didn't sign?
Oklahoma.
There you go. You win our prize. Heidi Moore, live in New York with us. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
Not far from where Heidi is sitting at the moment on Wall Street. Not as good a day as you might think. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, on to news item number two now, the other long-awaited deal. And don't quote me on this, but there is a debt deal in Athens. It's not about bond payments, though, or renegotiating existing debts with the European Union or the IMF. It's a domestic austerity package, deep budget cuts, and labor market reforms, all with the aim of convincing the European Union and the International Monetary Fund that Greece deserves a second bailout, $170-something billion. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Athens. He's been out on the streets all day.
Today, Greece's two main unions digested the details of the plan and they delivered their considered response. They poured thousands of protesting workers onto the streets and called a two-day national strike. Bystanders seemed to support the protest. Theodoros Sionis says, I feel betrayed. I've worked all my life. Now my pension's going down. Greece is being destroyed. The plan includes 15,000 public sector job losses and a 22% cut in the minimum wage. Greece is deep in recession. Birgitta Vavasselda says we don't need more austerity.
I don't think it's a solution to the problem of growth. Unless we solve the growth problem, in 6 months we'll be in the same position.
But without the bailout, Greece could suffer a messy default and a banking collapse. Some Athenians support the bailout plan. Pericles Sophronia says, I think this could make things better. But among public sector workers, like Despina Kutsumba, whose salary last month was cut in half, there's mounting despair and anger.
My daughter is 7 years old. Last year I was buying her a book every week. Now I can't do that. She asks me for a book and I can't afford it.
Greece's three main political parties have signed up to the bailout plan, but implementing it won't be easy. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This next story you can file under the heading Things We Pretty Much Knew, But Now There's Proof. It comes to us from Nielsen, the TV ratings people. They issued a report today that says younger viewers are spending less time in front of the tube. About 9 minutes a day less, to be precise. Nine lousy minutes. How big a deal can that possibly be, right? To advertisers for whom every minute counts, a bigger deal than you might think. We sent Marketplace's Amy Scott to see what young people are doing with all that extra time.
No, they're not taking in the fresh air or reading books. No, consultant Bill Carroll with Katz Television Group says instead of watching shows on TV, young people are watching them
on an iPad, on an iPhone, on the Internet.
Or as the character Eric Vander Woodson put it on Gossip Girl.
You know, who watches TV on a TV anymore anyway?
Actually, lots of people still do. Pat McDonough is an analyst with Nielsen.
So then the real question is the drop in usage on the traditional television set a temporary change, or is it the beginning of even more of our viewing going to other screens?
That's the big question for advertisers and studios. Tom Adams with IHS Screen Digest says advertisers can still reach TV defectors.
They're able to follow them, but not monetize their eyeballs quite as well.
That's because there are fewer ads in shows online. But McDonough says last year's dip in TV viewing may be overstated. She says in 2010, people watched even more television than usual because they had less work. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, so with the foreclosure settlement now in the books, it seems a good time to ask what Americans really think about it.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's here every week to talk with us for a segment we call Attitude Check, public opinion behind the news. Frank, good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So I'm going to take it a little bit sideways today and ask you to go to the interpolation side of the data that you guys collect. We have the news today on the mortgage settlement. We have our conversation last week about how people are feeling about real estate. Given the news of the day, how do we think, how do you, based on your experience, think Americans are going to feel about this deal?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, Kai, sometimes I'm surprised when we actually go out and ask people. We don't get the answers we think we would get. But I think it's probably fairly safe to say that Americans will be positive. As you mentioned, last week we talked about the fact that Americans like the idea that the government itself would get involved with helping foreclosed upon homeowners. And now that we have a settlement where it's the banks, which are held in fairly low esteem by Americans, are going to have to fork over money and help these foreclosed homeowners, I would say Americans probably think it's a good thing. And are happy that it's going to happen.
Let me ask you about that line you had about 20 seconds ago, which said banks are held in low esteem. You guys have data on that, how we feel about the banks.
We do. In fact, we have a question where we said, how much confidence do you have in banks? It goes all the way back to 1979. At that point, 60% of Americans said they had confidence in banks. Now, that's waxed and waned over the years. In the early 1990s, it fell again. There were some crises then. But then it had been back up to 53% as recently as the mid part of last decade in 2004. Said, yeah, we're confident in banks. And that plummeted again down to 22%. In 2009, and now it's inched its way back up to 23%, which is at the lower end of the range. So Americans don't have, on a relative basis, a lot of confidence in banks. We also know when we say, is your image of banks positive or negative, it's much more negative than it is positive. Mm-hmm. So banks aren't doing all that great at the moment.
Let me very quickly, Frank, turn to the other big story of the day, Greece and the Greek debt deal. You guys have asked people whether they think the European debt problems are going to affect us here in the States. What do they say?
Yeah, it's interesting. We put it in context. We gave them four things: trade relations with China, the financial situation in Europe that you just mentioned, the political situation in Iran, and then the debt being held, U.S. debt held by other countries. How important is that to you? How concerned are you about the impact of those on the U.S. economy? Very direct question. And actually, the situation in Europe was lower on the list. It was debt, number one; two, the situation in Iran; three, trade relations with China; and fourth on that list, 44% of Americans, less than half, say they are very concerned that the financial situation in Europe will affect the U.S. economy.
But still, 44% is not a small number.
That's right. Everything is relative, so that is certainly not a small number, but nevertheless, certainly not as many Americans concerned about the euro crisis at the moment as are concerned, for example, about Iran.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. You can find out more about it and some of the data involved as well on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Coming up, race, class, and crime novels.
The identity of this so-called middle class, really working class person, man and woman, has begun to embrace what black and Latino people knew all through the 20th century.
Author Walter Mosley in just a bit. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials inched up 6 points today. That's a fraction of 1%, finished at 12,890. The NASDAQ put on 11 points, 0.4%, ended things at 29.27. The S&P 500 gained a point, 0.1%, 13.51. You'd expect banks to get walloped today following that foreclosure settlement, and for the most part they did. Citigroup down 1.6%, Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan fell 1.1%, but Bank of America took home a gain of 0.6%, which is kind of interesting since B of A owes the largest share of that settlement, nearly $12 billion, to the homeowner fund. Groupon clipped off nearly 14% today. The daily deal site was an unexpected dud last quarter. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.04%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for December. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And if you didn't get enough of the Force the first time around, it's your lucky day. Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, is released in 3D. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You've heard, I'd imagine, about China's clout in the global economy, right? Its high and its low-tech manufacturing base, the sheer size of its market. What about fine art, though? You don't hear much about that, do you? Even though the list of the 10 most expensive paintings sold last year had three Chinese artists on it. And it's not just about the painters, either. Chinese buyers are doing their part as well. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has more.
In a studio in Shanghai, four men huddle close together. There's an art collector, two appraisers, and an artist. They're examining a painting of a flower by Chinese artist Qi
Baishi.
He is the Chinese Picasso. When he was alive, I think he was actually better than Picasso.
Appraiser Hu Xilin remembers a time when a Qi Baishi painting sold for around $100. That's when nearly everyone in China lived in poverty. Last spring, a Qi Baishi painting sold for $65 million, the most expensive painting in the world last year. The artist's worth has surged atop China's economic tidal wave. Art auctions in China, like this one in the city of Nanjing, are now commonplace. They're events where China's new rich loudly try to outbid each other for the shot at buying a piece of Chinese history. As a result, global prices for Chinese art have skyrocketed. Chinese buyers spent $4 billion on art last year. Lydia Thompson, an appraiser of Chinese art from San Diego, recently visited China to see it all for herself.
Say the Sotheby's and Christie's type auctions in New York is kind of a sort of very kind of buttoned down kind of place. Everybody's sort of subtly indicating that they'd like to place a bid, understated, one would say. And these guys are a little bit more, you know, a little bit more raucous and having a good time of it.
Maybe too good. Thompson thinks they're getting carried away.
What's been happening is that people haven't necessarily been making good on their bids.
After an overzealous Chinese bidder in London couldn't come up with the $82 million he pledged for an 18th-century vase, auction houses throughout the world have begun to demand deposits. And there's something else that doesn't seem right. Remember that Qi Baishi painting that sold for $65 million? It turns out one of China's largest TV networks bought it as an investment. All this has art experts worried that Chinese speculators are inflating a global art bubble. Hu Xilin runs an auction house in the Chinese city of Hangzhou.
These new investors, they see these auctions as a relay race. They don't even unwrap the paintings after they buy them. But there are many collectors in China who are rich and who do appreciate fine art, and I think they'll keep buying if this bubble pops.
Serious collectors like Sisson Yang. At his Shanghai studio, he carefully unpacks a Japanese teapot he bought at an auction last year that's made of solid gold. He's a connoisseur. But he also gets caught up in the frenzy of how much he can make.
I bought it for $50,000, and now it's worth $150,000. Everybody at the auction wanted to buy it. It was like 10 wolves fighting for a piece of steak.
Yang and his friends laugh at the thought of it. In the end, Yang had the winning bid, just like thousands of other Chinese art collectors are doing now in auctions around the world. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Walter Mosley writes what are, on the face of it, crime novels. Easy Rollins and Fearless Jones were two of his early recurring characters. His latest book is called All I Did Was Shoot My Man, featuring a misguided private detective by the name of Leonid McGill. The thing about Mosley's books, though, is that they're as much about class and race and economic inequality as they are about crime. So today in our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, Walter Mosley. Thanks a lot for coming in.
It's great to be here.
Tell me about your guy here, Leonid McGill.
Well, Leonid McGill is a private detective, different than most. For most of his life, he was a detective representing criminals. If you robbed a bank and you needed to blame somebody else, he would take the evidence and plant it on some other crook. And either that crook would get convicted, or at least you couldn't convict the original guy because there's, you know, a conflict there. He realizes at some time that he's been going the wrong way. And he's only recently in his 50s really realized how to go the right way in his life.
It became clear actually in this one that he has figured out how not to be the bad guy but the good guy.
Or at least how to try to be the good guy.
Fair enough. Do you like him as a person?
Oh, I like Leonid very much. I think he's like, you know, he's like, he represents to me the 21st century. He's a guy where everything has changed in the world. Like, you know, living in Los Angeles is a great example. You might want to say, I'm not going to move from place to place like everybody else.
Yeah.
But even if you stay in the same place, everybody around you moves. So you become nomadic even if you stay in the same place. The 21st century is like that. The world we knew is gone, and we're living in a new world even though we didn't go anywhere.
All right, so let me pick up on that a little bit, because there is a sense in this book that you just have to kind of play the hand you're dealt. You have to accept things the way they are and make your way in this world and in business and in life and the economy the best way you can.
No, that's right. You have to. And with every step you take, something changes.
Mm.
And the same thing with race. You know, race, it used to be there were black people and white people and everybody thought the same way. Now everybody thinks, every individual person thinks a different way. And so everything is different all the time.
Leonid McGill is not a new character, but he is your latest character.
Yes.
Previously, you had a guy named Easy Rollins as your protagonist. How has your view of the world and the economy changed as you transferred between those two guys?
I think that people of color in the 20th century suffered under the weight of the distribution of wealth. That in many ways that if you were black or Latino in America, you were struggling in a way that the greater society, which was white society at that time, didn't realize. In the 21st century, everybody has become that colored person in America.
Hmm.
It hasn't changed, but it's broadened. The suffering has taken up a much larger space so the identity of this so-called middle class, really working class person, man and woman, has begun to embrace what black and Latino people knew all through the 20th century.
You talk about the 20th century as if it were a lifetime ago. But it is, I mean, it was like 15 years ago, you know, 40 years ago to 1971, 72.
Well, you know, I mean, it's like any kind of great economic disjuncture. If you have enough money to eat on Tuesday, but by Friday you're starving, Tuesday is a long time ago. And so I think that the change in politics and world economy has been so marked since at least 2001 for America that, yes, the 20th century is like, you know, it's just like, you know, 12, 13 years ago. But it's much longer than that because we're greatly removed from the potentials that we once had in this country.
So where does Leonid McGill go in this world you describe?
Well, you know, Leonid has to make a choice. Leonid's a tough guy, and he's not afraid to die, which is one of the things that you kind of have to be if you're going to go up against global capitalism. You know, when you go up against it, you just have to not be afraid. So Leonid says, fine, maybe you're going to kill me, and maybe I'm going to kill you, but I'm going to see this thing through to the end because you may not have morals, but I have at least some set of rules that I'm following that go against the corporation.
Isn't that kind of bleak, though?
If you look at unemployment in America and poverty in the world, and if you don't think it's bleak, I mean, it's bleak, but it's not inaccurate, I don't think.
Walter Mosley. I don't know where to go with that one. Walter Mosley, his most recent book is called All I Did Was Shoot My Man. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You can read an excerpt from All I Did Was Shoot My Man on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that shares of Apple closed at $493 a piece today. That makes the whole company worth more than Google, Goldman Sachs, General Motors, Ford, Starbucks, and Boeing combined. I mentioned that so I could mention this. There has been a lot in the press lately, in the New York Times and on public radio in particular, about working conditions in Apple factories in China. Apparently, we're worried about that, but only a little bit. There was supposed to be a big ethical iPhone protest at the new Apple store in Grand Central Station in New York today. 4 people showed up. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow inched up 6 points, a fraction of 1%, finished at 12,890. The NASDAQ put on 11 points, 0.4%, 29.27 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 0.1%, 1351. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope we'll see you again here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.